Welcome to Chem 12C. We will be doing a check-in in lab for section two. I'll briefly revise or review what it is that we're going to be doing once we get to the lab. However, I recognize I did a little bit of that too quickly this morning. There's so many of you that had me before that I guess I was just in such a mood not to have to recover the same types of safety issues and such, but I also did a little bit too little bit describing how the class is going to be put together, and more specifically, what is it that you do need to make sure that you come back to class with on Wednesday. So let me at least address those issues. There is, of course, item number one, which is goggles. So make sure that when you get goggles, if you don't have some already, that they are the kind that are able to wrap all the way around your eye. They have to have side protection as well. If you go to some place like Home Depot to get your goggles, make sure they're not just work goggles or garden goggles, that they're actually chemically rated goggles. You need to get something specifically for chemical environments. Besides your goggles, you need to have a lab book, which, does anybody have their lab books with them? I just want to show you. It just needs to be some simple composition book, just like this, whether it's plain paper, lined paper, graph paper, log paper, paisley paper on the inside, it doesn't matter. As long as the pages are not spiral bound, and as long as the pages are not perforated where they can be easily ripped out. It does need to be a bound book, but it does not need to be a special lab book, meaning it does not need to be leather bound, acid free, archival page type of book. Besides those two things, you do need to have your pre-lab. So the morning section, I described pre-lab, but maybe didn't pointedly enough say that you do have a pre-lab that is due on Wednesday, and that's because we are beginning our first experiment on Wednesday. So for the morning section, if you didn't get those page numbers, it was 617 through 619 for the theory, and then 619 through 620 for the lab itself. The aldol condensation, that's the name of our first experiment. And I did confirm it is a topic that we're not getting to quite yet in lecture. So we're going to have two chunks of material, concept-wise, that we're going to be dealing with here at the beginning of the quarter. Aldol condensations, which I won't make any further mention of today. And then carboxylic acids and the derivatives, which is, in fact, what our lecture today is going to be about. The last thing I'd say to make sure to bring is appropriate clothing. So we did discuss how you need to have closed-toed shoes and you need to have appropriate clothing otherwise. And I recommend that you bring an extra set to change into, both because we'll have changing weather conditions and you never know when you might have to change out of them because of some major laboratory accident. Now, for section one, any introductory questions before we get into lecture? To section two, I'll hold you off and say that we are going to have time to discuss in the afternoon. So if we have any new students in section two, there'll be plenty of time for you to ask questions there. But since this is the last chance today for section one, particularly the new students to ask questions, if you'd like to do so, now's the perfect time. Now, section two, I didn't see anybody on the wait list when I looked this morning, so I'm not worried about enrollment. So if you're here, you're here. And then in the lab, then we'll check roll properly there. We are going to have our first lecture today, which is on carboxylic acids, but let me make a brief comment about the syllabus. I'll just tell you the full truth, which is I didn't get grades in until probably about an hour before they were due. And I, like you, wanted to have a little bit of a spring break, so I started on the syllabus yesterday morning, when I got a call that one of our full-time instructors would not be here because there was a death that occurred in his immediate family, and another instructor let me know that she couldn't be here because of a minor medical issue, but still something that would prevent her from teaching the first day of school. So instead of working on the syllabus, I was working on finding instructors for these courses. So it's just another quarter where something wacky has happened. But I will be posting that syllabus sometime by Wednesday, but I'll tell you what it is that we're going to be doing. It's carboxylic acids, and more carboxylic acids. And you'll see from what I go over today the types of things you need to worry about, at least for the next 72 or 96 hours, by which point we will have the syllabus up. And any further comments about the syllabus I'll make once it's actually posted so everybody's had a chance to download it. The old version is online. The topic order will be roughly the same as that version online. The lab text and the lecture text have both changed, though. So, because realize that what's online is a 2008 version, so quite a bit's happened since then. So do not use that to go get your textbooks. I forgot to bring the ISBN numbers with me, but let me just tell you, it is Bruce, B-R-U-I, oh gosh. Bruce, kinda, oh dear. I forgot, this one doesn't love me very much. A little better. B-U-I-C-E for the lecture text. And it's Gilbert and Martin for the lab text. I don't require that you purchase any particular lecture text because I don't assign problems for you to turn in. I will be making recommended problems for you to practice on. My real recommendation is do as many as you got time for. But because I don't collect them, that's why you don't have to have a particular lecture text. So particularly those of you who are jumping in just at this point, instead of forking out the $200 or whatever you got to spend for a textbook now, if you wanted to use the previous one, that's fine. Just realize there might be little things here or there that your textbook might have extra or that might be missing. If you are going to use an alternate text, you might just want to come wave it at me. Just make sure it's one I recognize and could recommend. Because there are several good books on the market, but there are some simpler texts. One specific case is we used to use the, I'm blanking on the name. It's been long enough now. Well, I guess it doesn't, but there's one textbook we used to use for years and years and years, loved it. But it's been geared more and more and more to the pre-med market, where they don't get as much in-depth coverage of mechanism. So, McMurray. So if you have a late edition McMurray, it's not heavy enough in detail for this course. If you have an early edition McMurray, it's still a beautiful text. So just recommend you might want to show me your text before you end up the whole quarter with it. I guess that's all the comment I have on lecture text, though. So should we begin an actual lecture? Sure. The first 2 weeks of this quarter are going to be rough, which I know is exactly what you don't want to hear, but you might as well be prepared. Because we have carboxylic acids, which, let's just make sure, what is the structure of a carboxylic acid? How would you identify something as being a carboxylic acid? COOH. So some kind of R group attached to a carbon that is both a carbonyl and an alcohol, you could say. We have carboxylic acid, but there's a bunch of other compounds that you just change a little structural feature, and so therefore they're very related, both in terms of just structure, but in terms of reactivity as well. And in fact, the Bruce textbook is not the only one that does it this way, but it's a little bit unusual, because the author treats all carbonyl compounds as essentially the same thing, that react in two principal ways. We've treated aldehydes and ketones as a separate topic, and we did that in Chem 12b. But now we have all the other carbonyls that we're going to cover in 12c. The way the textbook is written, it actually deals with these functional groups from 12c first, you could say. So it shows you a lot about carboxylic acids and their derivatives. And the point of telling you that story is, one, for the returning students to say we're going to go back to all those sections from those chapters we skipped before and now get to them. But for new students to emphasize the commonality of all these derivatives, that they do behave a lot alike. The reason I want to stress that is because we're going to learn certain types of reactions, like reduction or hydration, throwing water at it. And instead of memorizing the same mechanism for each of these different functional groups, I recommend that you try to see the patterns. Because let's see how many different functional groups we're going to have to worry about. Here's a carboxylic acid, but what would it be called if I put an alkyl substituent on?
an ester, that's right. What if instead of just an alkyl group, I substituted the oxygen? With either an alkyl group or a hydrogen, but on a nitrogen.
What functional group is that?
We had never talked about it before, so I wasn't necessarily expecting anybody to know it, but thought you might have seen it in maybe one of your bio classes. It's an amide. Which, recall last quarter we had amine, imine, imine, and now we're going to have amide and imide. So we didn't have enough words, you're going to soon. If we replace the oxygen, the singly bound oxygen, with a halogen. Does anybody remember from last quarter what kind of functional group that's called? An acyl halide. And remember that acyl refers to the portion including the carbonyl, but not what's attached to the carbonyl. One functional group we didn't get is one like this, where we have essentially two carboxylic acids that have been joined together through one oxygen. Well, if you wanted to take two different carboxylic acids and join them together like this, what would you have to take out? And that's why these are called anhydrides. Literally meaning without water. Let's see, we have esters, amides, acyl halides, and hydrides. I might as well show you the imide. So an imide is kind of like the nitrogen equivalent of an anhydride. But there's a big difference in the reactivity of oxygen versus nitrogen, which is partly why this critter has its own functional group name. So imide's when you put one acyl group on a nitrogen. Sorry, amide is when you put one acyl group. Imide is when you put two. There's one more functional group that actually belongs in this family. But it might be a surprise. So triply bound carbon nitrogen. Does anyone happen to know what that functional group is called? A nitrile. And you might say, well, there's no carbonyl in there. But what we're going to learn is that under the right conditions, this can be converted into an amide, which then can be converted back to carboxylic acid. So that's why nitriles are part of the carboxylic acid derivative family. Now, I was commenting earlier about wanting to learn about patterns of reactions instead of just memorizing, because here are seven functional groups. And let's say we wanted to learn about hydration. That's one reaction. There's reduction. There's alkylation. There's solvolysis, which is kind of like hydration except using an alcohol. So there's four reactions I've named right there. And seven functional groups. Throw into that whether it occurs under acidic or basic conditions, which not all of those reactions can occur under those conditions. But let's just, for theoretical sake, say they could. So seven functional groups, four reactions, two conditions. So 2 × 4 × 7 = 56 mechanisms in 1 week. One lecture, really. So if you wanted to treat each functional group differently, fine. But are you going to want to memorize 50 whatever different mechanisms? Now, that's kind of a what if, but the reality is closer to having to know 20 reactions just in this first few lectures. So the first couple of weeks are kind of rough. shall we see some of these different reactions then? Because here are the functional groups. This is where we're going to be living the next few weeks, is this group of carbonyl-containing, or in the case of nitrile, triple bond-containing compounds. Maybe actually before we get to how they react, we should talk about the fact that some of these are more reactive than others. We should talk about the order of reactivity. Has anybody studied in their other classes carboxylic acid derivatives at all? So does anybody have no clue then about what the relative reactivity would be? Well, let's use some education guesses then. Right, we got a lot of brain power in the room. So out of these, which might you guess is the least reactive? And leave nitriles out. Nitrile, I'll just tell you, is less reactive than the rest of these. But out of the remaining carbonyls, and therefore related compounds, which one do you think might be the least reactive? Anhydride, okay. I'm not saying right or wrong yet, just seeing your guesses. Amide. Was that amide or imide? Imide, okay. Any other guesses? How many people agree with anhydride? How many people agree with imide? How many people don't care and just want the answer? Well, let's talk about the imide. Who said imide? Why would you guess imide?
Because there are two sides of the whole compound, and they are symmetric in some way.
Okay. So I see where you were going with that. See, last quarter we talked about how aldehydes are more reactive than ketones. And we used an argument of hyperconjugation to explain why it was that aldehydes are more reactive, because they lack the stabilization provided by hyperconjugation. So Emerson, you thought there might be something similar going on here. The better question then would be, what is the reactive part of that molecule? Is it the nitrogen or is it the carbonyl? It is the carbonyl that is still reactive in all of these cases. So really it's the same kind of question that we had before as far as hyperconjugation, or what about full-on conjugation? Which of these groups could have any stabilization of the carbonyl using what's attached to the carbonyl? In other words, by resonance, which one of these have any stabilization? In other words, what I'm asking is something like this. If I have an ester, which we'll do nomenclature some other day, I want to focus on reactivity today. Let's say we had an ester like this. I could, in theory, write a resonance structure where I push a single bond lone pair to the carbonyl, forcing the carbonyl open. And making something which is admittedly not stable. You know, if this was a carboxylic acid salt, which, oh, I guess that's kind of a side group. If you take an acid and neutralize it, you make a carboxylic acid salt or a carboxylate. And I'm going to leave that out of any discussion for the moment. In those carboxylates, though, there is resonance stabilization that occurs because there's always a negative charge. Here we end up with something that has both charges. But it still happens. And you might remember from last quarter when we talked about benzene chemistry, that even though oxygen's electronegative, it provides more electron density through resonance than it withdraws by its electronegativity. What about halogens, though? We have acyl halides here as one of the functional groups. What is the reason a halogen is a deactivator even though it's an orthopara-director? Withdraws more electrons than it donates. Why? There's two different cases, remember. What's fluorine's story?
It's the same size roughly as carbon, so it has good orbital overlap, but it's so darn electronegative that it's going to pull electron density away. So if you had an acyl fluoride, you've got oxygen and fluorine both pulling on the same carbon. That makes that carbon super duper delta positive, which is why acyl halides are the most reactive of these. What about the other halogens? What about a chloride? Chlorine is less electronegative than fluorine is, but why is it still in electrophilic aromatic substitution a deactivator? It's a big atom, so it has poor orbital overlap, and so it does do resonance, but not very well. And it's still electronegative, so it pulls more than it supports. And so acyl halides are the most reactive of the functional groups. Let me first, for particularly the new students that maybe didn't get that in-depth discussion about the deactivating nature of halogen, let me talk about it because it really is the same thing going on here. So first I'm going to talk about how halogens donate by resonance, but as they give, they take away. I'm going to link that then to the acyl halide being the most reactive of those functional groups, and then we're going to use similar logic to then decide amongst the rest of these which are the less and then less and then less and less reactive. Because there's one other way to consider all of these, and I want you to think of that. Think of another way, maybe once I show you a reaction mechanism, that we can argue whether one of these functional groups is more reactive than the other. So first, about halogens. Halogens undergo resonance, or can undergo resonance, which now is as good a time as any to say this once, and I'll say it only once through the core for the whole quarter. There is no such thing as resonance. Resonance is the fact we can't write a structure on paper because our writing system is inadequate. It's the fact that bonds can cover more than just two atoms, but we have no way to write that. So we write these things called resonance structures and then say, well, it's really in between the two of these things, or three, or four, or five. But that means no one structure itself is real. That argument we don't care much about until the next time we do a SMOG, which for those of you returning, you know what that means. And for those of you who are new students, I'll leave you blissfully ignorant just for the moment. But what I'm saying is that they can undergo resonance, but the better word is delocalization. So halogens can undergo resonance since halogens have available lone pairs. However, overall, more electron density is withdrawn by a halogen than donated. And that splits off into two cases. For fluorine, it is similar in size to carbon, so it has good orbital overlap. But it is the most electronegative element. And the buzzword to describe what happens is induction. That because of that electronegativity, it induces charge to move about. Now, in the case of the other halogens, which that's going to mean for us chlorine, bromine, and iodine, they're less electronegative, but they have poor orbital overlap. Since they're not the same size as carbon. That means they don't donate,
as much through resonance, yet they are still electronegative. And so this is one way of explaining that acyl halides are the most reactive carboxylic acid derivative, because how is it that carbonyl compounds react? Why is it that carbonyl compounds react? In fact, if I just come up with some general group Y to stick onto a carbonyl, we could suppose that there are two things that might happen. Either that Y is so darn electronegative that it's going to cause the carbonyl to be delta positive. We know that the oxygen is going to be delta negative anyways, because oxygen is more electronegative than anything else except fluorine. But just how delta positive the carbonyl is depends on what Y is, what's attached to it. And since you're going to end up with a delta plus at that carbonyl carbon no matter what, that's why there's two ways that a reaction can occur. One way is to be sneaky about it, to throw an acid in that will affect the delta negative portion of the molecule. But which will therefore lead to a proper carbocation. So if you had something, some group Y, that donated a lot of electron density at this point, well, that means it's going to be less reactive. If you're making this a nice stable carbocation, why would the carbocation want to react? But there's another way that this reaction could begin. You could have some really strong base that comes in to force the carbonyl open. And again, we have the delta positive here that would attract something like a Grignard reagent, for example. So I'll keep it more generalized and just say B negative for the moment. But the other possible mechanism is for something to force that carbonyl open. Now, what if group Y is a leaving group? Because we have an alkoxide that maybe could collapse back down and kick Y off. So it's not SN2. We didn't kick something off the same time something came and substituted. But there's still substitution occurring. Notice that what I've shown you is a cationic mechanism and an anionic mechanism. And these are the starts of all the mechanisms we're going to learn. Or this is the crux of the mechanisms we're going to learn. That there's going to be a way of activating the carbonyl by pre-protonating it. So you're kind of teasing the carbonyl to reaction. That's where you're using a weaker base, like an alcohol, to attack. Think of making a ketal from a ketone. Worked by exactly that same top mechanism. Protonate, carbonyl opens, and then at that open point, something attacks. Think of the Grignard reaction, and that's like the anionic mechanism here. Something comes in and attacks and pushes the alkoxide, or pushes the carbonyl open, making an alkoxide. But last quarter, we didn't see this next step. Well, that's how carboxylic acid derivatives are different. So, before I show you any more mechanisms, though, I've shown you enough to now have this argument, or this discussion. I just made one argument where I said the acyl halide is reactive because there's not much electron density being put into the carbonyl. If there's not a lot of electron density being put into the carbonyl, then this carbocation that would form would be less stable, and it would be a more attractive carbon for something already negatively charged to attack. But isn't chloride a good leaving group too? So maybe I'll show you one anionic mechanism. I had an acyl halide, whatever that halogen might be, and hydroxide. You could show the following two-step reaction. The first hydroxide attacks, you form this tetrahedral intermediate, which I know you all know what the word tetrahedral means, but that's an important buzzword in this series of reactions. And we'll talk about why on Wednesday when I'm not going to run out of time. But from this tetrahedral intermediate, because a halide's a good leaving group, well, let's say we're not using fluorine, it can get kicked off. And notice we then made a carboxylic acid out of an acyl halide, which is why carboxylic acids are less reactive, because they're the products you get from an acyl halide reacting. That halogen's a leaving group. Why don't we look back at the other functional groups and see what's a leaving group? So a halogen, that's a leaving group. Acyl halides are reactive. And anhydride, the leaving group would need to be a carboxylate. Is that a good leaving group or a bad leaving group? Well, it's not great. It's kind of in between. Because what's the pKa of acetic acid, roughly? 5. If the pKa is 5, then what does that mean about the basicity of its conjugate? It's high, but not as high as hydroxide, right? So it's not a great leaving group. It's worse than a halide, but it's better than a hydroxide, which is why anhydrides are more reactive than carboxylic acids, but less reactive than acyl halides. There's two ways to argue this, and let me summarize all these different thoughts that I've just thrown at you, because I've shown you lots of little bits of things. So let me put the package together. Carboxylic acid derivatives. Are carbonyl containing compounds. Which means they normally react due to the partial positive charge on the carbonyl carbon or due to the partial negative charge on the carbonyl oxygen. And so that gives us our two classes of reactions. Cationic reactions, which are normally stepwise. Which, if you might recall, there's two flavors of mechanisms. Concerted, which means everything happens at once. Stepwise means one thing's happened, and then the next thing happens, and the next thing happens. It's usually stepwise, and it's usually acid catalyzed. And so normally, protonation occurs to cause the formation
of a carbocation. Then there's anionic, which is normally something like a Grignard reaction. It's concerted, and it's base promoted.
The reason acid catalysis is called acid catalysis is you start with an H+, and at the end you lose an H+. So H+ came, H+ went, no overall difference. That's why that's one of the classic ways of describing what a catalyst is. In the base reaction, the base either gets used up, well, it gets used up one way or another, which is why it's called base promoted. And these, again, cationic is corresponding to taking advantage of the oxygen, making the oxygen react to get at the carbonyl carbon. Anionic is where you attack the carbonyl carbon directly. But because it has to do with something with the carbonyl, then any factors which stabilize the positive charge on a carbonyl carbon will reduce the reactivity of that carbonyl compound. Any factors that reduce the positive charge on the carbonyl carbon will decrease the reactivity of the carbonyl. So, saving a little bit of time, because we could discuss each functional group at length, but here is the order. Acyl halides and hydrides. Carboxylic acids esters, and then imides and amides, since they differ just by the number of carbonyls, but otherwise are the same type of reactivity, I'm just going to discuss amides. And they're the least reactive, which we hope would be true, since all of our proteins are made of amide bonds. When they say amide bond, that's not a bond, it's a particular kind of connection. Exactly what I've got shown here, a carbonyl connecting to that nitrogen. Why is that so unreactive? What's more electronegative, oxygen or nitrogen? Well, oxygen's on the left here. Oxygen's more electronegative, pulls more electron density. Nitrogen, less electronegative, less electron density. Also, that lone pair is super duper delocalizable. Remember pyrrole from last quarter? How easily a nitrogen's lone pair can be pulled into an aromatic system? This is not aromatic, but it's the same type of thing. Nitrogen pairs delocalize easily. If it delocalizes easily, it supports the carbonyl. It reduces the positive charge in the carbonyl, makes it less tasty to a base coming from the outside, less likely to react. Versus over here, we talked extensively earlier about how a halogen, even though it is something that can participate in resonance, it withdraws more electron density than it gives. If it withdraws electron density, it makes the delta positive more intense, makes it more reactive. That's way number one of expressing the difference in reactivity of these compounds. Now there's way another two of demonstrating the reactivity of carbonyl carboxylic acid derivatives is focusing in on this type of substitution, this carbonyl substitution. Again, as a reminder, the overall transformation was a carbonyl compound reacting with a base to displace some sort of leaving group. Well, again, listing the carbonyl carboxylic acid derivatives, let's look at what would have to be the leaving group. So there's the different functional groups. There's what would be the leaving group. So notice that the basicity of the leaving group increases as we go left to right. Which, going back to Chem 12A, think of SN2 reaction. Good leaving groups are the conjugate bases of strong acids. So the conjugate acid strength increases as you go to the left. Section 1 already got the warning this morning that acid-base chemistry is going to come back this quarter. So some of the things I mentioned to Section 1 were things like the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, the half equivalence point and how it's tied to the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, what a conjugate is, what a pKa is. Those four things, if I were to ask you a quiz question about what they are, that's the level you need to re-understand them. Because we'll talk about all of that by the time we hit amino acids. We've already hit part of it here, though, just by me mentioning this acid-base conjugate pair. You're going to be memorizing pKa values later on this quarter as well. So just this year, your next in a series of warnings that you need to revive your acid-base chemistry. To get to the point right now, though, the leaving group ability, the basicity of it, that's bad for a leaving group. So the reverse of that is the increasing reactivity. So we've got two ways to explain why it is that the carboxylic derivatives have the order of reactivity that they do. Now, I've done an awful lot of talking this morning, so what about some questions? Anyone got any yet? Then, with the brief amount of time that I've got left, let me give you an overview of a cationic and anionic reaction that we're going to spend a lot of time next time discussing. Since I've shown you this dichotomy of reactivity, let me show you some examples of it. And actually, we may only have time for me to get through one of them. The first one is Fischer with a C, Fischer esterification or deesterification. The overall transformation is the following. A
carboxylic acid is flooded with an alcohol. I'm using ethanol just because it's a very popular example. Plus some kind of acid source, which, if you're not familiar with this abbreviation, TSOH stands for tosic acid. Which, since some of you know enough my love of tosic acid that you put it on my birthday cake, could you please tell me why it is that tosic acid is my favorite choice of an acid catalyst? Cheap. Always good in synthesis. It's organic, soluble. It's a solid, so it's easily measured out. But what is its most important chemical qualities? Strong acid, that the conjugate base is weak and non-reactive. So once it does its acid catalysis, it doesn't do anything else. So the result we get from this is an ester. One would hope, since it's called an esterification reaction. Let me very quickly show you the mechanism. And I say very quickly because it's going to sound very familiar to many of you. Because if you're putting an acid in acid, you know, notice this. We're trying to protonate an acid. And here's a question I'm going to want an answer to next time. Why isn't it the carbonyl that gets protonated first and not the other OH group? Who knows who I'll call on to answer that question on Wednesday? This is my new audience participation ploy. So as long as I remember to, at the end of a lecture, I'll ask a question for the next lecture that you won't know who has to answer, which means you all have to study. What? You mean we have to know something, Dr. Gray? How dare you? Notice the reversible arrow, which, yes, you really do need to know is a reversible arrow, and yes, in this mechanism, you really need to use, because it's tied into the whole point of this, which the whole darn reaction's going to end up reversible. But after protonation occurs, the carbonyl opens. Well, it doesn't, because there's no such thing as resonance, but on paper we do it. And after that point, that means that ethanol can come in to attack. What do you think the next step's going to be if I've had protonate, open, attack, deprotonate? So the steps here, protonate, open, attack, deprotonate. Which, if I could just put little X's and zeros with them, that'd be the PlayStation buttons you could hit to practice, and you'd remember it, right? Some of you PlayStation people out there. POD, in other words, which is exactly the same mechanism we learned last quarter to make a hydrate or make a ketone. Notice that if we drop the OH group, this is the same mechanism as making a ketone. Exactly the same. But this is a carboxylic acid, which is why there's a little twist at the end. And a question that we'll discuss next time is, wait, if we've got three oxygens here, how do we know which one's going to react next? Well, the answer is yes. All three of those oxygens react. One of them will bring us back to the starting material. The other two will bring us forward. Depending on how we influence the conditions using Le Chatelier's principle. Yeah, equilibrium comes back this quarter too. So using Le Chatelier's principle, we can make the product happen. But since we're out of time, let me hurry up and show you the answer. Protonate again, just like last quarter. We make water, so the bond to water opens. We have, unlike last quarter, a second oxygen at this point. So instead of another molecule coming into attack, the carbonyl reforms. And so the last thing to occur is for deprotonation. We are out of time. Any quick questions before we end? Yes. All right, see you on Wednesday.